everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and this is It's All About Food. You know, I didn't do a show last week because my dad was in intensive care. I've been talking about him quite a bit over the last few months, and I wasn't going to do the show today because he actually passed within this week. And then I was thinking about him. I've been thinking a lot about him. And I thought how connected he was to food. My dad loved food. And I know that a lot of my activism is related to his passion with food. But it's interesting because I've taken a very different path with regards to how I feel about food and what food can do for our health and for our environment and all the things that are connected with food. So I thought, I'm going to do this show today, and I'm going to do it in the memory of my father, Harold Hartglass. So this show is going to be about food, like all of my shows. And I think we all might learn something in the journey during this next hour. My dad had a lot of expressions, and I've used some of them on this program. I think the most popular one that I've used, which I actually used in my eulogy for him during his funeral service, was this one. No one gets out of this world alive. You can't argue with that one, right? I don't think he really realized what that meant until about a couple of months ago. In some ways, many of us think we're going to live forever. It's hard to imagine not living, right? But at one point, the plug is pulled out of the wall and it's over. So we all do leave this world at some point. And the question is, how do you want to leave the world? How do you want your life to be, and how do you want it to end? And for me, I really believe we should all live as long as we can with the best experience we possibly can have in these bodies that we're in while we're here in this lifetime. The highest quality we possibly can, and that means we need to take care of these bodies with excellent nutrition and exercise and mindfulness. But life gets in the way. For my dad, for example, he was a depression baby. He grew up, he experienced the depression, and we always wondered, my siblings and I, if that had affected his approach to life. When we'd ask him if he loved food because during the Depression there was food scarcity, he would say, no, I just love food. He was very matter-of-fact about things. But I can't help but believe that it didn't have an impact, because for him, he wasn't like a foodie, someone who was a gourmand, who was interested in the variety or the quality and the unique flavors. No, what he liked, and he was entirely justified to like whatever he wanted. It was his life and his choice. What he liked was an abundant amount of food that was inexpensive. He liked a lot, and he liked it cheap. So it's hard to not think that the depression, when he may have experienced going hungry from time to time, did not shape his interaction with food in later years. What was it, in the 70s, the 80s? When did those salad bars and buffets come out? Does anyone remember? We used to go to some of those when I was growing up, and it was always such a celebration to see all of the different amounts of food, all different kinds of food, and you could have as much as you wanted. It was just like a dream come true, all of this food and as much as you wanted for one price. And as I got older, personally, I realized I didn't like those kind of arrays. Number one, I would pile on like different spoonfuls of different food, and you never knew what you were tasting because there were so many different flavors and textures all at once. I now know I like eating one thing at a time. This is my own kind of my own compulsion, my own obsession. I eat one thing at a time. I like to concentrate on one thing at a time. I like to savor it and enjoy it every mouthful. And then, if I'm still hungry, I'll work on something else. I'm not a fan of those all-you-can-eat buffets. And now they've probably become a lot worse than they were when they first came out. Because, as we know, in restaurants, many of them struggle. I don't want to point the finger to restaurants, but it's hard to run a restaurant. And one of the things you have to do is control costs. An easy thing to do is go for inexpensive foods, the foods that come in large quantities, that are industrial in nature. Many times, restaurants will opt for foods that are already prepared so that they don't have to do much to it. And as a result, there might be artificial chemicals and flavorings and our favorite trifecta, the sugar, salt, and oil. And I find most of these buffets, they're just, even if it's like raw vegetables or a salad, there's kind of something funky about them. So I'm not personally one who gets excited about buffets or all you can eat or big quantities of food for very little money, because there's a price that you ultimately pay when you're not eating nutritious, quality food, and that price is the quality of life that you live. Now, my dad was a good man. He was a good provider, and he wanted the best for his children. He wanted his children to have a better life than he had, and he demonstrated that in many, many ways every day when I grew up. So when I think about his choices and how his choices were not in line with my choices or my philosophy, I don't want to judge. And it makes me realize when I'm doing my own activism and working to imprint my own philosophies on other people because I think I'm right. I have to, number one, not judge and approach every conversation with compassion and think that that everyone is like my dad, who is basically a good man, basically someone who wants to do good. But doesn't have the I'm searching for a word here, doesn't have the capacity, or maybe doesn't have the knowledge or the ability to understand the bigger picture. My dad was a smart man. A smart man, but he didn't have the ability to understand the connection with what was on his plate, with who was on his plate, when it came to eating animals, or when it came to the impact on the environment. it's something that he couldn't process. And I can't really explain why that is. And I'm sure each one of us is very different in terms of our own intelligence and our ability to understand concepts and what we want to know and what we don't want to know. It's really a challenging picture, but it doesn't have to do with whether or not we're good, whether or not we're compassionate. It's the brain is fascinatingly complicated. My father, he liked routine. He had his breakfast when he got up. He wanted lunch around noon. And then when he would come home from work, when he worked full time, he wanted his dinner. He was a three square meal guy. He had to have his meals right around the same time every day. And it was really important to him. And for me, I've mentioned this many times, I don't eat until I'm hungry. And many times I'll get up in the morning, and I should have done that this today, but I didn't. I get up in the morning and I have a big glass to drink and maybe make some tea, and I'll do some work, I'll do some exercise, and then when I'm hungry, I'll have breakfast. Sometimes for me, breakfast doesn't happen until like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. But I don't live a typical schedule. I don't drive to an office with a day job, and that absolutely can influence your food routine. And it influenced my father's routine, but he was that kind of person where routine was really a part of who he was. Whether or not he was hungry, and I can't tell anyone whether they're hungry or not, but he just had to have his meals on time every day. Another thing was he would never cook. Never. He might, maybe, warm up a can of soup. Maybe. He might boil some water for tea, but that was like his repertoire. He would not prepare food, and this was something that was ingrained in him as a child. His mother adored him, and he was just made to believe that the women around him would make his food. Now, as a feminist, this is something that always irked me, but late in life, I was trying to engage with my dad at one point and talking about preparing food. And it was just one of these knee-jerk responses. It didn't compute. It was something that he did not do. And some people could look at that and say, wow, how sexist is that? Yeah, it is. It is. But it was so deeply ingrained in him. Doesn't make it right. Doesn't make it wrong. It just is. And it's important to understand that. I don't think he was hurting anyone with that belief other than himself, because he might have done a lot better if he had learned, maybe not to cook, but I find when people learn to cook, they learn to know what's in their food. And I think that's important. We need to know what's in our food. That was something that he wasn't concerned about. Once again, he wanted food that was on time and a lot of it. So he would never cook. And, you know, he had a classic arrangement with my mother. They both agreed to this, maybe not verbally, but it happened from the time that they lived in society. they got married. When they were young, my dad was the financial provider, and my mom took care of the housework, and she raised me and my brother and sister. She made the meals. She did take a job for several decades, part-time. But of course, she was still responsible for the housework and the cleaning and the cooking. My dad occasionally, well, not occasionally, my mom tried to train him over the years to get him to do some household chores. He always took out the garbage. That was one of his jobs. She did get him to do some vacuuming, but never cooking, never making meals. And Dad was very picky when it came to food. He didn't like cucumbers, red cabbage, or raw onions. And if there were little specks in a dish that were green, like parsley or any kind of herb, he would say, "What's that?" And he wouldn't want it. It was very childish, actually. And some of my dad's dealing with food came with a very childlike nature. And it's easy for me to kind of figure out where all of that came from. My dad lost his father when my dad was 6 years old. And my father had to take on a new persona when he was six. I don't think he really had an adequate childhood. So there were some parts of him that never really grew up. And one of those things was being picky about food. So he would say, like I mentioned earlier, he had expressions, and one of them was, "What's that?" whenever there was something in his food that he didn't like. And I would always wonder about that, because you could add some of those foods that he didn't like. If they were disguised, he would have no problem eating those foods. So I frequently ask myself, does he really not like them, or does he not know that he could like them? Actually, over time, it did introduce him to eating some new foods that were good for him. But it definitely was a challenge for him. So I just wanted to take a moment and talk about my grandfather, who I never met, my father's father, who was murdered when my dad was six. This is a fascinating story, and I've always wanted to take the time to research more about it, which is on my list. I'll get to it. And if you know anything about this, maybe you could help me out. My grandfather was a milkman, and he was part of the union. And he was murdered around 1933-1934. And this was during the time of the milk mafia. Perhaps you heard about that. And he was killed by a group called Murder Incorporated. Yeah, I mean, you may have heard these names. They just sound like things you'd hear about in a movie. But my grandfather was an activist, and it's not even clear to me if he was, which side he was on. if he was really in support of making higher wages and supporting the milkman, or if he was a hustler, I have no idea. But he was an activist. He was involved in the union. And this is another dark side of milk, dairy. We've talked many times on this program about how milk, how cow's milk, how goat's milk, animal milk is not appropriate for human health. I think it's one of the worst things you can put in your body. Some people call it liquid meat. We had Dr. Neil Barnard on the show not too long ago when he put out his latest book, which was about cheese. And when you make cheese from animal milk, it's filled with lots of saturated fat and cholesterol, things that do not promote a healthy lifestyle. Growing animals to acquire milk is devastating on the environment, at least in the quantities that we produce today. And it's also horrifically cruel. And people just don't get this. I was just responding to a New York Times article that just came out on the feminism of goat milk production. I forget the title exactly, but it was about how more women are getting involved in raising goats and making goat milk. And the story, it was fascinating. But it painted a picture that was romantic. And this idea that women raising goats in their way was the right thing to do, that they were better caregivers for goats, and that may indeed be true. There was a comment by one of the women who raised goats that boys don't give milk. The boy goats don't give milk. The boy cows don't give milk. Boys in general don't give milk. So why not have the girls or the women take care of the girls who give milk? But the underlying thing that no one got in this article was that whether it's men or women who raise these animals, it's still exploitation. These animals still have to be artificially inseminated, artificially impregnated, raped in order to get pregnant and have a child so that their mammaries fill with milk that we can steal from them. And very often, if the baby is a male, it's slaughtered for meat. So there's always this underlying, hidden cruelty that many people don't process, they don't understand, and they don't want to understand. And I don't understand that myself, how that happens, but it's part of human nature. And like my dad, the people who feel this way, they're not bad people. It's just difficult to perceive reality in one way as others may perceive it. So my grandfather was murdered. And if you go back to those times, even today, the financial incentives behind milk production are such that there's a lot of corruption. There are a lot of favors that happen. There are all the stories about President Nixon and what he did to help milk farmers and milk distributors in terms of the milk taxes that went on. And the way that we protect dairy farmers with subsidies and things today, it's all about protecting this particular industry. Now, dairy farmers are really starting to feel the pinch today because more people are demanding plant milk. And I don't think that we need the government to step in and say, let's help these farmers. And unfortunately, there are going to be some farmers that are going to struggle financially because their industry is ultimately, hopefully, going to fail. And I just wish that they could have the foresight to realize that they need to modify their business, and some of them are. Some businesses are, instead of making animal milks, are moving to making plant milks. Or if they're raising animals to produce milk, they learn to use their land to raise other things. It takes time, it takes money, it's not easy. But sometimes you need to realize that you're in a business that isn't going to be successful. And maybe if you can open your eyes a little bit wider or shift the focus a little bit, you may realize that the product you're making is not as beautiful and as wholesome as you originally thought. And it takes a lot of courage to do that. I realize that. It's not an easy thing to do, not just the cost and the capital investment involved in making those changes. It takes courage to look back at your life and say, I made some mistakes. I didn't see things as I see them today. I thought I was doing something good, and now I realize that there was evil and cruelty, things that I didn't acknowledge. That takes a lot of courage. Okay, so my grandfather was a milkman back in the 30s, and he was murdered for his activism in the union, and that affected my dad. He had to take on being a man for his mom and his baby sister. And then my grandmother remarried and had another daughter later on. And my dad wasn't very talkative about what went on as a child, so there's a lot of things we just don't know. And when we're talking about milk, my dad had a hard time with milk. He was a frequent nose blower, and I really believe that was because he had constant inflammation that was related to milk. Over time, he learned, I'm so proud of him, he learned how to drink soy milk and almond milk, and on his routine morning breakfast cereal, he would use these plant milks. And I found it did help him. He wasn't blowing his nose as much in his later years. And another thing, okay, my dad and my mom, both of my parents, are very supportive of their children. They've always been that way. And back in 1996, was it 1996? Maybe around 1999, I started becoming involved with a nonprofit called Earth Save. Do you remember Earth Save? Earth Save International was founded by John Robbins after he wrote the groundbreaking bestseller Diet for New America in 1987. There was such an outpouring, people responding to this book. They wanted to do something. That John Robbins and Michael Clapper, Dr. Michael Clapper, was involved in this. They came up with this name, Earth Save, founded this nonprofit, and created chapters all over the country where people could meet and have community. This was before meetups. This was before the internet, and people needed a way to get together and share their like-minded ideas and learn how to create foods that fit their ideals, food that didn't involve cruelty, food that didn't involve devastation to the environment. And then I got involved with the group in the late 90s. I was the executive director for a time, and I had a local group in New York City, and we would organize dinner lectures. The classic Earth Save event was to have a potluck, find a social hall, and people would bring food. They were told what kind of food to bring, what was accepted and what wasn't accepted, all plant-based. And I thought it would be easier, especially in New York City, where people don't really cook very much, to arrange a fixed price dinner or a buffet. I talked about buffets earlier, and bring in a speaker. And I did it in New York City, and I also had another group on Long Island and did that there. And often I would get a speaker who would speak at both groups one day after another. And my parents, they would come. They came to many of these events, which was really lovely. But it didn't really have an impact on what they were eating, at least not my dad. Numerous times, however, my mom would hear a very passionate speaker, and then she would say, I can't eat chicken anymore. I can't eat beef anymore. I can't do it. I'm going to go vegetarian or go vegan. It happened many times with her and one of her best friends that would also come with her husband to these meetings. It was cute. It was sweet. But it never lasted. I remember Bruce Friedrich came to one of the events, and if you've ever heard him, you know how passionate he is, how knowledgeable he is. He just spits out all of this information packaged in so much emotion, and it just gets to your soul instantly. And both my mom and her friend said, okay, here it is, we're doing it, we're not going to be eating these animals anymore. And it lasted a couple of weeks. And then they went back to their old habits. And there's lots of reasons behind that, and I'm not going to judge them for that. It's just unfortunate. That's why these groups, these meetings that we had were so good, because they created a community, and for people that really wanted to stick to the change, they had other people that they could socialize with that were also at the meeting that could help them along the way. But when you're with other people who don't feel the same way, and you go out to eat, and you go out to restaurants that aren't really serving anything that seems interesting to you that is plant-based, then it becomes more complicated. Fortunately, over the decades, this has changed quite a bit in many areas, and now there are many vegan options that are tasty and interesting, and it makes it easier. That access is so important. We sometimes thought that maybe my father had some issues that might have been considered falling within the autism spectrum. And which made him not want to do anything outside of his routine. He liked his routine, he didn't like changes, and so we thought maybe there was something like that along the way. But, you know, he was a great provider, as I said. He was really a proud, wonderful father. And one of the things I remember, I had lived in France from 1992 to 1996. So I became a vegan in 1988. I was living in California. I actually became a vegan on a business trip when I was in Israel for 3 months. It was a great place to make my transition with food. And then I lived in France for 4 years, and then I returned home to New York, where I was born and grew up. And I was actually living at my parents' home for a few years while I reestablished myself after living in Europe. And I didn't want to celebrate the holiday of Thanksgiving with a turkey. Now, we just went through Thanksgiving. We actually missed our Thanksgiving this year because my dad died the day before. And Gary and I were making a lot of food Thanksgiving Day that we were going to bring to my mom's house after the funeral. When the going get tough, the tough cook. That's how I deal with difficulties sometimes, because I find that for me, cooking is a form of meditation. It's relaxing for me. It works for me. Anyway, back to Thanksgiving. So I was living at my parents' home, and I basically said, if you want me to be at your Thanksgiving dinner, there can't be a turkey. It's either the dead bird or me. And maybe that's not the best way to go about it, but that's what I did. And fortunately for me, my parents were okay with that. And we actually had a local TV station come on Thanksgiving Day to film the foods that we had prepared before we sat down and had dinner, and it aired all day on this station. It was really fun, and my dad was very, very proud of that. We had stuffed tomatoes. What else did we have? I made a pumpkin pie, of course. And that was, like I said, in the late 90s. My pumpkin pie has evolved since then. And I just keep making new versions that appeal more to my evolving tastes. And I'll talk a little bit more about pumpkin pie in a little bit. So, one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about my father and my understanding about my father's connection to food is because it is helping me with my activism. It's helping me understand people by understanding him and realizing again and again that people are inherently good. People want to be good. People want to do good things. I remember when I gave my talk to 250 cattle ranchers about the impact of animal agriculture on climate change. I opened my talk and said, "We all want the same things. We all want clean air to breathe, clean water to drink, nutritious, abundant food for ourselves and our children. We all want these things. We are all inherently good. Just some things, life happens sometimes. Misunderstandings happen. Disconnects happen. Brainwashing happens. Manipulation happens. Guilt happens. So many things happen, and if we want to make change, I believe it has to come from a place of love. Otherwise, I just don't think people will respond well and be able to open their hearts to receive the message. Like many of us, we like the foods we were raised on, and my dad was no different. He liked plain tomato sauce. He used to talk about this brand, Del Monte tomato sauce. Are you familiar with that? That's what he was raised on. It took years before he would open up to enjoying tomato sauce with a little more flavor, a little more texture. But when it came to comfort food, it was the foods that he was raised on that were satisfying. He expected things in restaurants. Now, in Chinese restaurants, that was, I'm like laughing to myself as I acknowledge all of these things. He knew in a Chinese restaurant that it wasn't going to be like an Italian restaurant that he could get. But even so, in the Chinese restaurants that he ate in when we were younger, they had a certain style. They had white tablecloths. They always poured their black tea like an oolong tea. And all the dishes that came out were in metal trays, metal round dishes with pedestals and covers. Do you know what I'm talking about? And the covers would keep the food warm. And it was like a little buffet almost on our table where we would order three or four or five dishes and they'd all come in their covered dishes, and we'd take what we wanted on our plates and put the covers back on and enjoy our meal. That was Chinese food. And in years to come, many of the Asian restaurants did not stick with this tradition, and they didn't come in these metal dishes with pedestals and covers. And the dishes wouldn't even be covered. And this frustrated him to no end. He didn't want his food getting cold. And another one of his expressions, in fact, when he would receive like an egg roll or something and he would bite into it, he would look up at the server and he would say, "Cold." Which meant, "Warm it up. I'm not happy with this." In other restaurants, no other restaurants served food this way, and that was okay. But if he was in another Asian restaurant that didn't serve food in the way that he was familiar with Chinese food, it bothered him a lot. And this is where I think he might have fallen somewhere in the autism spectrum, because he couldn't go with something that was out of the routine of what he was used to. But, you know, many of us, no matter where we are in terms of our mental abilities and health, if we're used to something a certain way and then we see it differently, it can be very jarring. It takes a certain amount of experience to learn how to go with the flow and be fluid. I'm kind of getting off the track here, but I think when you have the opportunity to travel internationally and see the way other people live, you can learn to have that flexibility a lot more easily when you see that there are so many different ways to live, so many different ways to eat, so many different ways to be considerate and polite, and a different cultures approach life in many different ways. You can open up and see that it doesn't have to be one way. Quite the contrary. But back to restaurants, if we weren't in a Chinese restaurant, if we were in any other kind of restaurant, my dad wanted bread and butter on the table. And if a basket of bread was offered and it didn't have butter, he would have a fit. And as time went on and as cuisines became a little more fluid, if I may use that word again, some restaurants didn't put butter on the table. They would put a little dish of olive oil, like many Italian restaurants or Italian fusion restaurants. And he would just get so frustrated. He didn't want olive oil. It wasn't what he was used to. He wanted butter. And he would, by the time he was ready to talk to a server, he was so angry. I always wondered, where did that come from? Did it come from some depression error experience? Where did that anger come from? It was something that I could never get to the bottom of, because I wanted to give him relief. And I'll never know. But, you know, oftentimes we do that with so many things where we're experiencing something, and before we even engage with someone, we've had this inner dialogue that brings us to a fever pitch where we're in a heated argument before we even open our mouths. We are fascinating, aren't we, human beings? And there are some restaurants today, they don't even put bread on the table, which I think is a good thing. It's a healthier thing. So my dad's dealing in restaurants and with food was classic. So much so that when he was 75, my brother and I made a film about my dad and my mom going to a restaurant on his birthday. And we used all of the expressions that he has used over the course of his life and talked about all the food issues that he had. It was really quite humorous, and I have to give my dad a lot of credit for going with it and enjoying all of us kind of poking fun, but at the same time doing it in a loving way. So here are a few more things, which I think are really depression era related. When he was served a cup of coffee, he would get frustrated right away if it wasn't filled almost to the brim. He didn't like putting milk in the coffee, and he wanted a full cup. Now, it didn't matter if it was a tiny little cup of coffee or one of those big giant ones. He wanted it filled. Where does that come from? And especially in places where you could have unlimited cups of coffee, why would it matter that the cup itself be filled? He felt the same way about wine. And for those of you who are wine drinkers and know this, when you get red wine, you always want to leave some space in the glass for the wine to breathe. You don't fill the wine up to the very brim. Unless you're serving my dad, that's what you want to do. So that had to have come from a place of want, a place of scarcity and need. Now, okay, so I have a lot in common with my dad. My dad was never a vegetarian or a vegan, but our reaction to food is in many cases very similar. For example, as I mentioned earlier, if he didn't know what was in his food, like he saw little green specks, he would become frustrated and he would want to know what is that. He wanted to know if it was in his repertoire of food that he ate because he didn't want to eat something new. And I want to know what's in my food too, maybe for different reasons, but I need to know what are the ingredients. Now I come from it from a very different place. I want to know if the ingredients are things that I want to put in my body. Are those ingredients sourced from animals? If they are, I'm not going to eat that food. I don't want synthetic, man-made ingredients in my food. I want things that came from the earth, that grew without toxic chemicals. So knowing what's in my food is very important, and it's something that I have in common with my dad. So there were some nice changes where I actually saw some growth in terms of foods that he was eating. There was one time I went to dinner with my brother and my dad, and I think it was it a Chinese restaurant? He was served a plate of food, and he complained that the portion of chicken that was on the plate relative to the portion of vegetables was not what he wanted. And he said, there's a mob of vegetables and a postage stamp of meat. And he was very disappointed. And then I really marveled because years later, he reversed that and he learned to enjoy his vegetables to the point where we were at one of those Earth Save dinner lectures at an Asian restaurant, and they served a bunch of dishes, and one of them was a like a faux chicken with broccoli, and it came out and there was this big piece of faux chicken and the broccoli all around it. And my dad was like, where's all the broccoli? I want more broccoli. Little things that you never forget. So my dad had prostate cancer 21 years ago, and I'm not sure exactly when it returned, but I know it was the basis of all of his health challenges in the last 5 years or so. And that's frustrating to me because we've learned from Dr. Dean Ornish specifically and some other plant doctors that prostate cancer is one of those cancers that can be prevented and can be reversed once diagnosed. And that can be done with a whole foods plant diet. And I gave that information to my father many, many times, and he wasn't really interested in learning about it. And as a result, he had many complications related to it over the years, and I think that's ultimately what brought on the weakness, the fatigue, and the failing, ultimately, in his body so that he died this week. Now, he lived a long life. He was going to be 90 in February. So he was 89. And for the most part, he lived a pretty good life. But again, that was frustrating to me, but helps me with my own commitment in educating about food, because I don't want to see anyone go through what he went through. And he didn't really have much pain. He had some discomfort towards the end, but Like I talked with Dr. Joel Fuhrman a few months ago when his book came out, Fast Food Genocide. In the opening of my interview with him, you may have remembered, I was actually at the New York Blood Center with my dad, who was getting this immunotherapy treatment. And I did the interview from there. And the first thing I asked Dr. Fuhrman is, how should we die? We talk about reducing risks of all these chronic diseases, heart disease and diabetes and cancer, obesity, autoimmune diseases. But if we're living a healthy lifestyle, what does death look like? And he explained that basically we just slow down, we get tired, and we die peacefully in our sleep. And I want that. I want that for everyone. I don't want to see unnecessary pain and suffering when we know how to prevent it. It's really quite simple. And another thing that was curious to me about my dad is that he really believed in the medical profession. He religiously went to his doctors and got his regular exams, was always happy to run there and be examined, and been given pharmaceuticals, pills, whatever, that would address his needs. He was so good about that. And what surprised me is when he was young, he had some hearing problems, and the expertise and knowledge about the ear canal and hearing was not as good as it is today, and they actually butchered him, and I think did more damage than he had at the time, so that he was always hard of hearing. And he, thanks to technology, wore hearing aids in the later part of his life, really big kind. And I think they were big for two reasons. One is he needed a lot of help, and two, he never really upgraded to the most sophisticated, higher technology versions because they were more expensive. But those hearing aids really helped. But it surprised me that he didn't have a more cautious relationship with the medical profession after they did what they did to him as a child. Yep. Many, 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 many things that I will not understand. So I said I would talk about pumpkin pie. Yeah, I wanted to do that. So I've been a vegan for almost 30 years. So one of the first things that I had to figure out how to make was pumpkin pie back in the day. So it was easy to make a pie crust with white flour, white wheat flour, and I would use olive oil or vegetable oil back in the late 80s when I first started. The vegan butters were not as sophisticated at the time. Sometimes I would get a margarine, and those margarines back then were just horrifying, made with all kinds of horrible ingredients. And not always vegan, but of course I started to read the labels back then. And I would make the pumpkin filling with a tofu and the canned pumpkin and the spices and sugar. It was okay. I didn't love it. And then as time wore on, I learned how to make a better filling. Now I like to use coconut milk with my pumpkin, but if you don't like the taste of coconut, you could use a cashew milk, a mixture of plant milks. There's so many options today. And I skip the tofu. Not that I don't love tofu, I do, but I don't like it, the texture that it creates. I want a lighter, more custardy filling. And so I can do that with the pumpkin and plant milks that have a consistency of heavy cream. And then the pie crust, over time, I moved to a whole wheat instead of a white flour, and I would use some of the better vegan butters. After that, I started preparing crusts that were gluten-free instead of made from wheat, And more recently, this year, I had the challenge where I not only did I want to make a pumpkin pie that was vegan and gluten-free, but I wanted it to be flour-free and sugar-free. And I was so thrilled with what I came up with. Now, this is not a recipe for people who are used to very sweet, sugary foods. But for my palate, because I don't put sugar in anything anymore, it was perfect. The filling was sweetened with date paste, which I made myself from pitting dates and then boiling them in water and pureeing them. And the crust was made with almonds. And it was really fantastic. I will post the recipe very soon for those of you who might be interested in such a version of pumpkin pie. Some and my other versions are up on the responsibleeatingandliving.com website as well. So that's pumpkin pie. The last thing I wanted to say before I go is that today is Giving Tuesday. Giving Tuesday comes after Thanksgiving and Cyber Monday, and it's the beginning of the giving period before the big winter holidays. And as you may know, I run a nonprofit called Responsible Eating and Living, and Responsible Eating and Living is the producer of this show. It's all about food. And we invite you, if you enjoy our recipes and our programming, and if our website has helped you and your loved ones in any way, that we hope you consider visiting us at responsibleeatingandliving.com and contributing on this day, Giving Tuesday. Thank you for that. So, you've been listening to It's All About Food. Today was another program all about food in memory of my father, Harold Hartglass. I'm Karen Hartglass. Thank you for joining me today. Have a very delicious week.